Who doesn't love monarch butterflies? Could you imagine the loss we'd feel if they completely disappeared? And what about the ecology? Our guest on Central Standard today will talk to us about the decline of monarch butterfly populations. It comes down to a loss of habitat. We'll find out what's going on and what we can do to help to turn things around. I'm Bill Anderson. We'll also talk about threats to the so-called killer bee and the implications of that. Orly Chip Taylor was trained as an insect ecologist and some 20 years ago founded Monarch Watch. It's an organization designed to help us learn more about monarch butterflies. Moreover, Mr. Taylor hopes we'll be inspired to help. It's Central Standard, but first the news from NPR. Welcome to a fundraiser edition of Central Standard. We've tried to put together a pretty stimulating show, plus we'll be asking you to help support public radio a bit later. But first, insect ecology. Specifically, in this first segment, the monarch butterfly. Our guest, Chip Taylor, is an ecologist and researcher at KU. The monarch butterfly has been an area of emphasis and concern for Chip for quite some time. That's why he started a website. It's called monarchwatch.org. And that's where I found this quote attached to a news release. In real estate, it's location, location, location. And for monarchs and other wildlife, it's habitat, habitat, habitat. Good morning, Chip Taylor.
Good morning, Bill.
Nice to have you here. And explain that quote.
Well, one of the things that all wildlife needs, you know, their basic needs, they need food and they need shelter, they need habitat. And what we're not really aware of generally is that we're losing a lot of habitat here in the United States. And this has been particularly true for the monarch butterflies and for a lot of pollinators. So habitat has been declining, and we've seen a precipitous decline in monarch butterflies as a result of habitat loss.
So we're talking about milkweed here specifically.
That's correct.
Yeah, or at least mostly, right?
Well,
yeah.
Mostly. I mean, the monarch butterfly has two life stages that really need support out there. That it needs support for the caterpillars, and that means that you have to have the host plants, the milkweed plants, for the butterflies to lay eggs on so that the caterpillars can develop so you can have more butterflies. The adult butterflies need the nectar. They need to visit flowers that have nectar in them. They take the carbohydrates from the nectar, and this allows them to energize themselves and to reproduce and to produce a lot more caterpillars. So you get this relationship between plants. So you've got host plants and nectar plants that sustain all of our butterflies out there. And they've simply got to have those or they're not going to exist. And so what we've been seeing is a pattern of loss of habitat across the country that has diminished a lot of different kinds of insects, to say nothing of all of the other types of wildlife. So my contention would be that we're not paying enough attention to maintaining the habitats that support these creatures out there, and we can do this. I mean, we have in the monarch migration one of the most magnificent phenomena on the planet, and it would be a shame to lose it, and we don't have to lose it, but and we won't if we pay attention to the habitat issue, if we create the habitats that these butterflies need.
So is it mostly driven by development then, the loss of habitat, or are there other factors such as maybe climate change, perhaps the use of pesticides and so forth?
Yeah, you know, Bill, there's a lot of different things that are involved in the changes that are going on in this country, one of which, the effects of monarchs in particular, is the loss of habitat due to the adoption of Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. Roundup Ready corn and soybeans are genetically modified crops that are resistant to the application of Roundup, but the weeds in the fields are not. And in the year 2000, a study was done that showed that the most productive habitat for monarch butterflies were the milkweeds that were in the corn and soybean fields. Well, at about 2000, that's when we started to see adoption of these Roundup Ready corn and soybean fields, and this has virtually eliminated milkweed over a large area. But we've also had some other things come along. We've had this initiation of all of the biofuel programs, which have consumed a lot of habitat in addition. Since 2007, 25.5 million more acres of corn and soybean habitat has been created in order to meet the demands of this biofuel thing. So we've got Roundup Ready corn and soybeans. We've got biofuel initiatives. We've got loss of habitat due to development of about 6,000 acres a day. So we've got a number of things. And then, of course, we've got erratic weather patterns. And you might even say climate change, which has had an impact on this population as well.
You referenced it as seasonality earlier when we were talking before we went live, and you mentioned that we're basically 12 days behind where we should be normally.
Yeah. So there's a interesting for your listeners. There's an interesting set of websites out there that you could go to look at what is known as phenology. That's phenology. Phenology. Phenology simply is the term that is used to describe the seasonal progression of events due to temperature and moisture. And this year, we are about 12 days behind where we should be. This is a late spring. This is a very, very late spring. 12 days behind is really unusual. At this time on campus over in Lawrence, it's usually in full bloom. It's usually in full bloom by the 14th of April. That's the, you know, I've been there a long time, and I've been watching these crabapple trees on the campus for a long, long time, and I have my indicator species out there. And they are days and days and days away from being in full bloom. So they're about 12 days behind. And last year, as you recall, we had the warmest March ever, going back to 1895. It was extraordinary. And at that time, we were about 3.5 weeks early. So we are probably 34 days different from seasonal progression this year from last year, which is amazing. I mean, that's...
Well, let me ask you this. We've got but 1 minute here. Help me understand, how does that affect the monarch? Destructive is that?
Yeah, that's a really good question. And what's really going on there is that it influences how fast the population develops. So last year, the population developed really fast, and it got too far north too soon, okay. And that was negative. Mm-hmm. This year, it's going to get to the normal breeding areas too late, and that's going to have a negative impact.
Okay.
So you've got to be just right. You know, it's the kind of the three bears theory of ecology. Sometimes it's too cold, sometimes it's too hot, and sometimes it's just right.
Our guest is Chip Taylor. He works at KU as a professor, a researcher, an insect ecologist. He's working to stop the decline in monarch butterfly populations, among other things, and we'll talk about it all over the course of this hour. I'm Bill Anderson, and you're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. Chip Taylor is here. We're talking about the plight of the monarch butterfly. Its numbers are down, and Mr. Taylor, an ecologist, researcher, and professor at KU, wants to stop the decline. Again, the short answer for those who joined us, it's a decline in the monarch, basically the habitat of the monarch butterfly. Now, I'm going to play a little bit of devil's advocate on you, Chip. I was looking at Kansas and the state of Missouri at the counties that have milkweed, and that's sustenance, essentially, for the monarch butterfly. It looked to me like there are, some 17 species of milkweed in Missouri and another 21 in Kansas, so... Yeah. Isn't that enough to sustain the butterfly?
Yeah, good for you for doing some research. That's terrific. Yeah, you're right. There's a lot of milkweeds out there, a lot of different types of milkweeds. There's about 75 different species of milkweeds in the United States, and that's an enormous number. It's far in excess of what we see for any other group of plants. And the number of milkweeds would seem to be important, but yet what we really need are milkweeds in the northern breeding area. This would be the area of the northern corn belt, be all across from, say, northern North Dakota all the way across to Michigan and then through southern Ontario and the northern New England states. That's where most of the monarchs come from that produce this migratory population.
Okay.
So they have to move through here to get through there. And so the milkweeds here are important, but the really important production takes place north of here.
Okay. Take us on a road trip with a monarch butterfly.
Yeah, I can do that. What the butterflies do is they go to Mexico. So let's start in Mexico where they're coming out of Mexico in the spring. They start coming out of Mexico in the last week of February. They arrive in Texas in pretty good, well, just initial numbers in the first week of March. Then they start really pouring into Texas. And as they do, they mate, they lay eggs on milkweeds, and then they progressively move north. And usually we see monarchs in Wichita somewhere around the 7th of April.
Okay.
And we see them in this area somewhere around the 20th. Well, they're nowhere close. I mean, they're still in Oklahoma. Last year, we had them in Kansas on the 17th of March, which was the earliest ever. Mm-hmm. And this year, you know, we're over a month after that. And we still haven't seen our first monarch in Kansas. So things are really different this year. But once they get into this area, most of them that have overwintered in Mexico are dead or dying. And then it is their offspring that take this migration all the way up to the limits of milkweed up around Winnipeg. And then you get one or two more summer generations in the north, and then the migration starts south again.
Okay. So by the time they get back to Mexico, we are looking at a third or a fourth generation monarch?
Yeah, you got it, Bill. It's okay. Generally the fourth generation that's overwintering in Mexico. But there are some third generations and even a few fifths in a few areas, yeah.
So would you describe the monarch butterfly as being endangered at this point in time?
No. The monarch butterfly is not endangered because it's really well distributed over a lot of different parts of the world. And humans have moved
milkweed. That's nice to hear, by the way.
Well, humans have moved milkweed around to a lot of different places. So we have monarchs now in Australia, New Zealand, and a lot of islands in the Pacific, and in the Azores, and even in southern Spain and Gibraltar and places like that. So the species isn't going to go extinct. What we're really worried about is the migration. And if you want to get a sense of what this migration is all about, you have to see an IMAX film, which is called Flight of the Butterflies.
Okay.
This is a film that I helped with a little bit. And then there's another one that's just come out this past week, which is called Wings of Life. This is produced by Louis Schwartzberg, and it's another film that I helped with. And we did a lot of that filming over in Lawrence, Kansas as well. And with the milkweeds that we have around our particular area in Douglas County. So we helped with both of those films, and they give you a real sense of what this migration is all about and how magnificent it is and why it's necessary to keep it going, because this is one of our biological mysteries, right? Yeah. How does this butterfly manage to get to these overwintering sites, you know, 1,000, sometimes 2,000 miles away? We had some recoveries of butterflies that were way up in St. John's this past summer that were recovered in Mexico. Just extraordinary. I mean, the longest flights ever. I mean, well over 2,000 miles to arrive at these overwintering sites. And how do they do that? I mean, we don't know how that's accomplished.
At what elevation, by the way?
Oh, they overwinter at about 10.5 to maybe 11.5.
Do they really?
Yeah. I mean, they're way up in the mountains, way up in the trees, and their clusters are magnificent. And one of the things that you see in this Flight of the Butterflies film is you see them break from these clusters. They cascade down. And you're an absolute orange blizzard of these butterflies. And if you see that film, one of the things that will be very striking to you is that you hear the rustle of wings.
Yeah.
You hear this murmuring of wings of butterflies. Can you imagine?
How majestic.
Can you imagine being any place on the planet where the predominant sound, if you're standing outdoors, is the rustle of wings?
Yeah, no.
I mean, that's fantastic.
It is.
Yeah.
You're right. Yeah, I agree.
Yeah. And it's a beautiful sight. And you get this a kind of a spiritual sense of nature when you're amongst all of this, because you just say, gosh, this is just amazing. This is just, this is wonderful. I mean, this is something that we have to keep going. And, you know, tourists go there every year because it is something really unusual.
Chip, I have to ask you, when did you know that this was at least one of your callings? Because you're so passionate about this subject.
You know, I've been passionate about a lot of things. I've been passionate about honeybees, too. I started out working with honeybees when I was 14 years old.
We're going to talk about honeybees later.
I've worked with honeybees, and I'm very passionate about them, too. So, hey, passion's what it's all about. That's what makes life interesting, isn't it?
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. What can I do? You know, I know this is really not just America's problem.
Right.
This is a worldwide issue here.
Right.
But what can I do as Joe Citizen to kind of help the monarch butterfly here in Kansas or here in Missouri?
Well, what we've done is we've started a program called Monarch Way Stations, and if people go on our website, they can look at the Monarch Way Station program. And what we've been doing since 2005 is to encourage people to create habitats for monarchs in their gardens. I mean, if you've got a garden, let's repurpose it. Let's repurpose all those gardens out there. I mean, we've got issues not only with monarch butterflies, but with pollinators in general. And so I was on a webinar yesterday with Disney folks out there in California, and this was all about gardening for pollinators. And my pitch was, you know, we've got big conservation issues that involve monarch butterflies, that involve pollinators that are declining all over the planet. And what we can do is that we can support the pollinators, the butterflies, the monarch butterflies, by repurposing our gardens and creating the kinds of habitats within our gardens without compromising our gardens, without compromising either the beauty or the integrity of the gardens, and we can still provide something for these organisms that are seriously jeopardized by all the other activities that we're involved with.
You know, it never ceases to amaze me. You know, we do a lot to destroy the natural environment as humans, but yet the planet seems pretty doggone resilient.
Well, you just wait. It's going to really change in the next 2 decades.
I mean, is it?
Yeah, it's going to change a lot in the next 2 decades. I mean, I teach a course which is called, you know, the World of 2040, and we look at what's going to be happening out there, you know, 20, 30 years ahead. And there are a lot of things that are going to change. I mean, we don't need to get into this in this particular talk, but, you know, the prospectus is that we're going to add 2 billion more people to the planet by 2040, and the consequences of that are just going to be enormous. And then CO2 is going to continue to go up, and the temperature is going to continue to go up, and droughts are going to increase. Yeah, there's going to be a lot of changes, and we don't need to talk about them now. But there is resilience out there, but at the same time, we need to be sensitive and responsive to the kind of changes that are going on, and we need to do something about it.
I want to go back for just a minute, in the minute that we have, to talk about my own yard, what we can do in our own yard. It doesn't even have to be a large plot of the yard, right?
No. You know, this is the field of dreams scenario. Yeah. You know, you create it and they will come, right?
Uh-huh.
And it may take a while, but they will find you. I mean, we have a garden out at the West Campus in Lawrence out of Monarch Watch, and it's amazing what shows up there, even though this garden is really isolated. Mm-hmm. It's just a little island, you know, in a sea of buildings out there, and yet the insects that use those host plants, the insects that use those flowers, find that garden.
Are there any other benefits? Do I start to attract other insect life or wildlife?
Yeah, in this little webinar I gave yesterday, we talked about all the different kinds of pollinators that you can bring to your garden. I mean, lots of really interesting flies, really interesting bees and wasps. And, none of these things are a danger to us. I mean, people are very afraid of bees, but bees in a garden are not a threat to anybody. I mean, unless you go and grab them barehanded, they're not going to sting you.
Our guest is Chip Taylor. He works at KU as a professor, researcher, insect ecologist. He's working to stop the decline in monarch butterfly populations. Stay with us. We'll follow a butterfly into outer space, and later we'll talk about the life of honeybees. I'm Bill Anderson. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. Our guest, Chip Taylor, is a researcher, ecologist, KU professor. He's taken it upon himself to help the monarch butterfly. Its numbers are in decline. Now, you have an event coming up, and you're inviting the public to attend it to learn more about the monarch butterfly and how we can help.
Yes, we do, Bill. We have a wonderful event we hold every spring. We actually have an open house and plant fundraiser in the spring. We'll have about 4,500 plants out there. We have plants that are rather unusual. They're not usually found in the box store sort of markets or most of the nurseries. We have plants that are specifically designed to attract butterflies and bees and other pollinators. And this is going to be held on the 11th of May on a Saturday from 8 until 2. And we invite the public to come out there, and we will also have quite a few games for kids. We have a lot of fun. It's a family sort of affair. We usually attract 800 people or so, and we get rid of a
lot. How many?
800.
Really?
Yeah.
Impressive.
And you know what? It's really amazing.
You have a Ferris wheel? Tilted twirl?
Maybe that. Hey, that's a good idea. We got to bring one of those in there. No, you know, we've got stuff that's really unusual, and people are interested in monarch butterflies, and generally they're interested in natural things. And so the amazing thing is that we've been able to attract people from different states. We've had people from Texas almost every year, had people from Minnesota last year, from Indiana last year. Mm. So people come from – they plan their vacations.
Yeah.
To attend this event.
Wow.
I'm going, wow. I mean, so we have a little bit of a following, and we try to put on a good show every year. It's a family sort of thing. It's a natural thing. We'll have face painting for the kids and, you know, little things of this and various
sure.
various games. And then we put on another open house in the fall, usually on the second Saturday.
Well, let's don't get too far ahead. Let's talk. I can find more information about it at monarchwatch.org.
Yeah, you just go to our website.
Okay.
And you'll see the information on the Spring Fund.
And fall's kind of the same thing?
Yep, that's right. Well,
okay.
Except we don't have plants then, but we have a lot of other things. So, yeah, their building has just been repainted inside, and so it looks a little bit nicer now, and we'll have lots of show and tell there.
Okay, and we'll have a link on our website later after the show. So your primary focus is monarch butterflies, but you've got your hands in a lot of things. You reference the need to restore habitats for other pollinators and other wildlife. Talk about that for a moment.
Well, you know, I'm particularly focusing on monarch butterflies, and I talk about that mm-hmm. because it's an iconic species, and it's a species that everybody recognizes and can understand. The average person doesn't know how many bee species are out there
right.
and doesn't recognize them, and there are lots of different families of bees, and they all use the same habitat. So when people ask me, you know, what good is the monarch butterfly? What happens if we lose the monarch butterfly? You know, why is it important? I say, really, you know, it's important because it shares the habitats with a lot of other species.
Right.
And if you look at what all of these pollinators do, they provide ecological services. They provide the transfer of pollen that keeps all of those plants going. And when those plants are pollinated, they produce the fruits, nuts, berries, seeds, and foliage that support everything else.
Mm-hmm.
So without the pollinators, you don't have the plants, you don't have the small mammals, you don't have the small birds. You really have a diverse, poor situation. And this diversity out there brings joy to our life, but it supports the planet as well. And, you know, it's something that we really have to sustain. If we don't sustain it, it's at our peril. I mean, if we turn everything into cement and asphalt out there, do you think we're going to be able to sustain the planet, to sustain the populations? I don't think so. We need those pollinators to provide the pollination for all those fruits, nuts, and berries that we eat. And that's about a third of the food that we eat. And it's a great deal of the variability in the food that we have available to us. Louis Schwartzberg asked me when we were working on that film down in Mexico, he asked me, would human beings be here without pollinators? And I had never thought about this. It just hadn't crossed my mind. And then I stopped to think about it. You know, before we had the angiosperms, the flowering plants, before we had the pollinators, the planet was dominated by gymnosperms that produce almost no fruits and nuts or anything that we could eat. And so where would we be without the angiosperms? Where would we be without this dance between the pollinators and the flowering plants? We probably wouldn't be here.
Yeah. Ladies and gentlemen, it's a lot to think about, and it's kind of – you're alarming me, to be quite honest with you, Chip.
Well, I'm sorry about that, Bill, but we have to have a little bit of alarm go off in our heads in order to do something about it. That's just the way we are, right? I mean, we're not intuitively altruistic, and we're not intuitively
right.
always acting in our best interest.
Going back to the monarch butterfly, it has four stages of life: egg, caterpillar, pupa, and adult.
That's
right?
Correct. Yeah.
How long is the life of a butterfly?
Well, if you talk about those immature stages, they're generally taking about 30 days most of the time. But if it's really cold, it can take up to 50 days. You know, this is a cold-blooded insect. Its development is determined by the temperature. For the adult butterflies, the summer butterflies are living, 2 to 6 weeks And then they burn out. They lay all their eggs and die. But the winter butterflies, the ones that migrate, those can live up to 8 or 9 months, which is really quite remarkable.
Yeah, and they're active that most of that time once they become adult butterflies.
Right. The migratory ones have a different metabolism, and so they can last a lot longer. And they're a lot less active than the summer butterflies are.
Coming up, we're going to spend a few minutes talking about another amazing insect, honeybees. Our guest is KU researcher, professor, insectologist Chip Taylor. I'm Bill Anderson. I'm glad you're tuned in. You're listening to Central Standard on KCUR and KCUR.org. Mr. Taylor, you've got a pollinator prairie that you've developed in Olathe, and what I find really incredibly exciting about it is you've repurposed a Superfund site.
Yes, and it's not me that's really done it. It's a partnership. I mean, there's a Superfund site out there that EPA and Boeing have been working on for quite a number of years to clean up, and they have done a marvelous job cleaning up that site. But there's a long way to go to clean up the underground contamination, and that'll be going on for years. But the surface of that area has been reclaimed. Mm-hmm. And we've got together with Boeing, with EPA, with Haley Aldrich, with another organization called Pollinator Partnership. And we worked with a local community group out there, and what we decided to do to repurpose that site was to produce a series of gardens that would be appropriate for pollinators. So we're calling it the Pollinator Prairie. We have a bird garden out there, a bee garden, a butterfly garden, and a monarch garden out there. There's a nice walkway there. You come to the end of Blake Street in Olathe, and you can see this area. We planted it last fall. We had a wonderful time planting it. I called all of my friends in the NGOs, and I got all of the teachers in the area that I could contact, and I said, hey, come out there and help us plant the plants. We've got something like 1,600 plants. We got to get them in the ground. It's going to take us most of the day. And we got 115 people to come out, and we were well organized. We knew what we were doing in terms of where the plants were going to go. We had all the plants delivered early in the morning. And, Bill, it was just amazing. 1,600 plants went in the ground in 55 minutes.
Wonderful.
Then we said, oh, wow, we expected to keep these people here all day. We got rid of this duty in 55 minutes, and now what are we going to do? So we had a nice little lecture about the history of the site from the EPA and the Boeing folks, and they told them, you know, what the whole background was, and they kind of filled them in. So what we're hoping to do with this site going forward is to engage the local schools, the teachers and the students, and recording what comes to this location, right? So this is a location right in the middle of Olathe. So what's going to show up there? What kind of butterflies are going to show up? What kind of bees are going to show up? We've got a bird garden that's supposed to attract hummingbirds. It's going to attract seed-feeding birds and also berry-feeding birds. And so there's going to be a seasonal change in the birds that appear out there, and it would be nice to get a record of all of that to document this. And it would be a learning experience. We've repurposed this whole area as a learning experience for the local population.
Before I let you go, we have to talk a little bit about the bees, because we talked about it earlier in the hour, and I don't want to let you go without having a conversation about the so-called killer bee. It arrived in the States right about 1990, I believe.
That's right.
And everybody was frightened to death about the killer bee. What's going on?
Well, they moved into Texas, and they moved into Arizona, and their populations have gone up and down with the amount of moisture, because the flowering goes up and down with the amount of moisture. And we've had some tremendous droughts in Texas, and that has kept their populations down. Unbeknownst to most of us, unless you really follow the bees, there are incidents every year involving these bees. There are people that are killed. There are people that are seriously stung and have to be treated. Usually what they do is they take these people and they perfuse them with fluids to keep the kidneys from going into some sort of kidney shock, kidney failure. And they've been able to save a lot of people that they wouldn't have been able to save in say, Mexico or other locations. So these bees have been involved in a lot of human deaths in the past, only one or two a year in the United States now. But they are a serious problem for hikers, yeah, in the mountains of Arizona and a few other places.
Easily provoked?
Yeah, that's the problem. They're really sensitive. And they get real nasty when they get disturbed. And they can come at you in literally the hundreds. And I've had quite a few experiences where it's been a little rough to deal with them.
And that's where the problem is. There are so many that will attack, right? It's not that the sting is especially lethal compared to other bees.
No. I mean, they're like the regular honeybee. They're just a little bit smaller. They're faster, and they sting in larger numbers, and they pursue greater distances. And so this is where they have been associated with a lot of incidents in which people and animals were killed. There was just a dog killed in Florida just last week. And it's usually animals that are tied up or confined in some way.
Is it true that they'll pursue up to like several miles?
Well, I've been pursued up to half a mile. And others, others claim up to a mile. So what you do is you walk through the brush and you don't walk upwind, you walk downwind.
Downwind.
Downwind. Okay. Go downwind.
Boy, I bet that sure got your attention, huh? Well, Chip Taylor, you look like you're in great shape for running.
Thank you.
Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, glad to do it, Bill.
Mr. Taylor is a researcher, an insect ecologist, a professor at KU, and we hope to have him back sometime in the near future. We hope you found parts of this episode surprising and discovered something new, something enriching, as we strive to deliver every day with our programming. I'm Bill Anderson. This is Central Standard, and you're listening to KCUR and KCUR.org.